Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. As always, I'm so glad you could join us as we look through the baseball card collection, going through boxes and binders and back to boxes and back to binders and back in time to a golden era of baseball. Or at least many people feel it's that way. Some people think of it as a little overrated period of overrated baseball. We're in 1964, and taking a look at 1964 Tops, card number 538, a high series card, and it had to be high series because this was Mr. Orestes Minoso's, or better known as Mini Minoso in the States. This was Mini Minoso's third stint with the Chicago White Sox, picked up right before the start of the 1964 season. And here he is looking much bigger than his actual size. Called Mini because he was 5'10 and 175 pounds, but he always made himself look bigger, and he is standing out larger than life on the 64 Topps card. And I say that 1964 is sometimes seen as an overrated period of baseball. And what I mean by that is people kind of let the 50s drag into the 60s a little bit. And when you're talking 1964, you're thinking of, you know, Mickey Mantle, you're thinking of Willie Mays, and you're thinking of all the sluggers from the 1950s. Well, the teams that were winning in the mid-60s, well, they were the LA Dodgers. You had, the Cardinals would win a World Series in 1964, rather surprisingly, too. You also had the Go-Go White Sox from the late 50s. And, of course, Mini Minoso, a big part of the Go-Go White Sox. It was all dink and dunk. It was small ball back then. And that's why some people look back at it and go, well, if you were a big fan of getting a base hit and having your next batter just get a base hit and just go, you know, station to station and win a ball game 2-1, then yeah, that was a glorious time for you. But not all fans are like that. If you're a fan of the long ball, the mid-1960s, early to mid-1960s were not prime time for you, even though some of the game's biggest sluggers were still in the game. It's just that the teams that were doing the small ball, the Walt Alston Dodgers approach to baseball were kind of taking over the sport back then. So we'll take a look at Mini Minoso's career and give you a case as to why the late Orestes Mini Minoso should be in the Baseball Hall of Fame. He is one of those interesting Veterans Committee decisions. Personally, I don't know, you know, when you look at some of the other qualified candidates for a Veterans Committee to elect into the Hall of Fame, the first name that comes to mind is Antonio Oliva. As you know, Oliva was a career 304 hitter and absolutely should be in the Hall of Fame. Amazingly isn't. And then, you know, you look at some more modern players like a Jack Morris, who, you know, you could make a good argument should be in the Hall of Fame. But we'll tell you why Minoso should be. There's a lot of reasons, and unfortunately, his major league numbers don't completely tell the story, because Mini Minoso had a career for a good 8 or 9 years before the major leagues and for several years after the major leagues in the Mexican League. So we'll discuss that in a little bit. Also, we'll talk about what you're talking about on our Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. We'll do that before the end of the show. And got some great commentary all throughout the week. A whole lot of discussions going on, so we'll touch up on those in just a little bit. And as always, I encourage you to spread the message about Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Send that link to your friends, those who collect now or collected back in the day. And let them know about the show. Wax Ecstatic comes out with new episodes on Tuesdays at 10 a.m. Eastern. And we have Flashback Friday episodes all throughout the weekend that we'll send out through our Wax Ecstatic Twitter feed at Wax and Gum Stains. Now, our home base is on Audio Boom, but you can also listen to us on iTunes, iHeartRadio, Stitcher, TuneIn, and Blueberry. So whichever your favorite podcast delivery method is, chances are we're on that platform for you. And you can not only listen to those new episodes on Tuesdays, but you can also listen to the archived episodes as well. Speaking of episodes, I'm not one for a celebration, but we should note that this episode is officially episode number 100. Yeah. We've actually done 101 recordings, but we did a bonus episode a couple months ago just to reveal the findings in our listener fan poll. But this is episode number 100. And as I've often joked throughout the history of this program, back in episode one, when I was explaining why I was doing this, I said, yeah, this whole little side project of mine is probably going to last 5 weeks. Well, here we are over a year later and 100 episodes later. So before we go diving into 64 Tops and Minnie Minoso, my thanks and gratitude to you. We've made it 100 episodes, not by accident. It's because you have been listening to this show for a while and you've spread the word as well. And I'm so glad that we could entertain you. And I'm glad that I'm able to, you know, help turn some people back into the hobby, taking a second look at a lot of the cards that you have, or giving you reason to go out and buy some more. And especially the classic cards here. I mean, you know, we put an early emphasis on the junk wax era cards, just because I think a lot of cards from those years don't quite get the credit that they're due. Some of them get too much. There's some pretty bad ones, you know, from the 1980s and 1990s. But, you know, especially the classic cards from the 60s and 70s, it evokes a lot of memories for a lot of listeners. And for those who didn't collect in the 1960s or 70s, or maybe you're like me, you know, I was born in 1977, so clearly I wasn't collecting baseball cards back then. But, you know, I had a love for vintage cards even when I was 11 or 12 years old. So if you're somebody who didn't really buy into cards in the 60s and 70s when you collected, well, I'm happy I'm able to give you some reasons to go out and find some. As I've said many times before, local card shops, unless it's a star card, they're not going to make a lot of money off of these vintage cards, so they will let you have them for a pretty decent price. And I've noticed quite a few listeners, if they aren't going through and reorganizing some of their sets from the 60s and 70s, they're exploring them and, you know, taking a second look at some of these cards too. And, you know, much like last week, when we were looking at 74 Tops and looking at the Dusty Baker card, and by the way, Dusty is out of a job in Washington. That absolutely sucks. But, you know, we talked about it on the podcast. I said, you know, Dusty's one of those managers. He'll get the team into the playoffs, but he just hasn't, you know, won the whole thing. So I'm hopeful that he can get one more chance somewhere. But as we were talking about with 74 Tops, that's a set that I really took for granted. I didn't really give it the attention that it should have when I was younger. 64 Tops is definitely one of those sets for me as well. And it's just one that, you know, again, contextually just doesn't quite match up to some of the other cards from that era. And as I've said before on the show, sometimes that's the key factor into why a card is, or a card set, is not as popular as you would think it would be. And if the early to mid-60s was a glory era in baseball, no doubt about it, it was a glory era for Topps baseball cards. First of all, they were able to swat away competition in 1963 from Fleer, and Topps was able to successfully say, hey, we're the only company that can offer up confectionery products with these picture cards. And, you know, Topps had all the Major League Baseball players, or pretty much all of the Major League Baseball players, under contract. They had complete control of the market. So, I mean, they're just in the driver's seat here. And they were producing some great cards. Some of my favorites, 1962 and 63. The 65 Topps set is one of my all-time favorites. So when you look at 64 Tops, it's really, really good, but not quite like 63 and 65. And, you know, I think that's, I've used this example before. If you fast forward to the 80s, you know, 86 tops is pretty good, but it doesn't quite get the attention it deserves from collectors because it's sandwiched around the popular 85 and 87 sets. And, oh, by the way, the 83 and 84 sets were also pretty popular. So it kind of gets lost in the shuffle, and I think 64 tops is one of those sets as well. Not quite up to the design standards of some collectors. There are a couple of quirks with the set that some collectors don't like, but I've said this before. We did 64 tops several months ago. Rusty Staub was our random poll from that podcast, and I've said before that I came around to 64 tops, ironically, through the Topps Heritage set. And that would have been the 2013 Topps Heritage set. And even then, I came late to the 2013 set. I didn't really buy any Heritage cards in 2013, strangely, because I had bought plenty in years before, and just for whatever reason in 2013, I just didn't really invest a lot of money in cards. And I went back, it would have been a couple years later, and bought several packs on eBay and opened them up and, you know, really loved how the 1964 design worked with the players from 2013. It just really, really impressed me. And I went back to my 1964 cards and kind of fell in love with them all over again and went out and bought some more 1964 cards. It was part of a lot of 1960s cards I purchased earlier this summer. Now, the main knock on 64 tops is the space that's devoted to words. In one word, team names. There's a lot of space devoted to the name of the team. As you look at this Minnie Minoso card here, there is no doubt about it that Minnie plays for the Chicago White Sox, as it blasts up top in light blue letters in that white frame at the top there, White Sox. And that would be the case with all other cards. The team name was prominently featured at the top of the card in large block letters. And a lot of collectors feel, and I can understand this argument, I don't necessarily agree with it, but a lot of collectors feel that this kind of takes away from the pictures. You know, Topps didn't really have action shots, but it really took away from the main focus, and that was the player in 1964. Now, I can understand that argument in the sense that, yeah, there is a lot of space devoted to the team name, and you can argue, too, there's a lot of space devoted to the player's name at the bottom of the card. But when you look at 1963 and 1962 tops, which are, again, collector favorites, there's actually a lot more moving parts with both of those sets. And, you know, there's about as much space devoted to the player picture in those sets as there is in 1964. Somehow 64 tops wasn't able to play it off as well as 63. But that is the main complaint. And like I said, the player's name is located at the bottom of the card, in a box that corresponds with the color to the lettering at the top of the card. Now, even though some people complain about this design, I actually like it, and here's my reason why. This is very, very, very representative of the times of 1964 in terms of marketing products, in terms of advertising, just in terms of the look, the feel, the sights, the sounds, the smells of 1964. I thought Topps really captured the moment so well. And that was one of the many goals of Topps throughout the years, designing cards that represented the time. And in 1964, in America, you're at a very interesting crossroads. You know, people think of the 1950s as, you know, hula hoops and Bobby Sox and rock and roll. And even though there was that kind of young uprising in the 1950s, It was still a very, very, very conservative time. And of course, as things are changing in the mid-1960s, you have, of course, the death of John F. Kennedy in 1963, ending a lot of the uprising and causing all sorts of confusion and sadness. You had civil rights marches and fights coming to a boil in 1963 and 64 and 65. And, you know, you have the Vietnam War is starting to percolate at this time. And the counterculture is really starting to go from just coffee houses and college campuses to the mainstream. In 1964, a lot of people, you know, when you look at the 60s historically, you know, when you hear the 60s, you automatically think of 1968 and, you know, the late 60s. But 1964 was a very interesting crossroads in America's history. And, you know, politically, you have the Civil Rights Act, which Lyndon Johnson signs into action that spring. You've got, the 1964 presidential election, which is, you know, the biggest landslide in history at that time, where Johnson just waxes Barry Goldwater. And you have the political parties, you know, basically flipping sides in the 1964 election there. You know, a lot of the standards that Republicans stood for, well, they went to the other side of the table, and a lot of the standards the Democrats stood for, they went to the other side of the table. So, you know, you think we're living in turbulent times right now, which we are, but 1964 was really, you know, kind of the fulcrum of the 1960s. You know, like I said, a lot of the 1950s carried over, but all of a sudden what was up was down and what was down was up, starting in 1964. So, you know, the 1964 look kind of captures that very basic conservative look on the outside when things are starting to go awry inside. And this is one of the last, you know, Mad Men era looks that Topps has. It's a very clean business look here, very Madison Avenue. And like I said, because, you know, the conservative and clean lines and cool colors that represented a lot of the 1950s and early 1960s in advertising, well, it would get turned on its head as well as advertisers were chasing that younger, more freer, more liberal audience that came, you know, to the surface in the mid-60s. And that's when you would see all the crazy colors and, you know, models wearing mini skirts and stuff like that. 1964, this is the last grasp of all things conservative and all things simple and all things, well, white, you know, very, very vanilla. And I think that conservative look, along with the rather rich tones of the first Cuban black player, it's an interesting little dichotomy here on this one card. I like the conservative look of 64 Topps. Again, as a broadcaster and a communicator in my life, you know, seeing the marketing side of things always stands out. And I think this is very representative of the times. Now, speaking of color, let's flip this card over. This is another reason why I like 64 Topps. I remember as a teenager when I was buying, you know, a handful of 64 Topps cards here and there, I always thought this color choice was an interesting one because it really stood out. And like I said, the front of the card held the conservative values of the time. The back of the card, definitely not conservative. A very, very bright orange. And on the white cardstock, it works. It works magnificently well. And I wish that Topps would use orange on the back of their cards a little more than they did. They would use a dark orange in 1972, although it wasn't the main color. But then they would go back to orange, the rather unique combination of orange and blue in 1978. And that's why that set has always stood out for me. Topps really wouldn't dive into orange on the back of a card until 1988. And you know, like I said, I wish they would use it more. Maybe it was a little more expensive to get than the dark green that they would frequently use throughout the 1970s. But I've always liked the orange look. It has that creamsicle look to it. The white cardstock with the orange ink, it just really pops. It just jumps right out at you. And like I said, it's kind of representative of the times where on the surface, on the front, it's all business, nice and conservative, everything's under control, and on the back it's, woo, orange, hey, and grab a nickel and scratch off the answer to this trivia question. It had a wild side. It's the mullet card of Tops, you know? Business in the front, party in the back, woo! So it's an interesting mix of colors and design and, you know, business in the front and who cares on the back. And I think that's really representative of the times. Now, I don't know if the designers at Topps were getting that cerebral about the design in 1964, but hindsight being 2020, and we have the ability to go back over 50 years and nitpick these card sets, it's kind of interesting how that came out. If it wasn't by design, then it certainly came out to represent the times all these years later. Now, the 1964 Topps set, despite being knocked by some collectors for its design, is still very popular, as this 587 card set has a couple of cards that really stand out. One is the rookie card of Phil Niekro, the Hall of Famer, Old Nuxie, but the other card is the second year card of Pete Rose. And why is this card so popular? Well, not only is it Pete Rose, but Rose's rookie card in the 63 set was one of those rookie cards where he was featured with three other players. And that was a standard design element by Topps used throughout the 60s. They would get away from it a little bit later on in the decade, but by the 1970s, they were back to putting multiple players on a rookie card. So a lot of collectors really like the Pete Rose second-year card, as he has that giant Topps All-Star rookie trophy on the card. And as somebody who's spent a lot of his life in Tampa, I can recognize the old Al Lopez field there in the background, as Pete is just smiling away in that classic pinstripe vest jersey that the Reds were wearing in the early 1960s. That card, by the way, card number 125, in case you were looking to dispose some disposable income, invest a few $100 on one particular card this weekend. Now, another notable card from the set, or other notable cards, I should say, rookie cards for Tommy John, also Richie Allen, Lou Piniella. And what's interesting about Lou Piniella is he's got one of those multiple player cards, but Lou is featured on three rookie cards throughout the 1960s. He actually appears as a rookie, a quote-unquote rookie, for the Indians, the Senators, and the Pilots before things are all said and done with his career. And Lou, of course, would go on and really get his career going with Kansas City in the 70s. But the first of three rookie cards for Lou Piniella shows up in the 1964 set. Also, speaking of Tampa-based managers, Tony La Russa's rookie card is in this set. And just like the Pete Rose card, if you're somebody who prefers the single shot card for the young stars, Willie Stargell's second year card is in the 64 top set as well. And also a unique card in the In Memoriam standard, Ken Hubbs, who died in a plane crash in 1963, honored with an In Memoriam card in the 1964 set. Although the ghost of Ken Hubbs would come up in 1966, as his picture was accidentally used on another player's card. Oops. So 1964 Topps, like I've said, it's a really good set. And I would really recommend, you know, again, go to a local card shop, or maybe there's a card show in your area, and go through the commons box of 64 Topps. If you're not concerned about the condition of the cards, chances are you can get them for about 20 to 25 cents a piece. If they're in decent condition, if they're a little beat up, you could probably walk away with them for 10 cents a pop. But it's not that hard to get maybe, you know, 40 or 50 of these cards for $10. And you can get some real gems. You can get some very interesting players, cards from very interesting teams. You know, this was the last card set to feature the Houston Colt 45s. By the way, congrats to the Astros and Dodgers on making it to the World Series this year. It's the last time you can see the Houston Colt 45s in card form, as they would change their name to the Astros in 1965. You also have the glut of other expansion teams. You've got the Mets, who were just absolutely dreadful at this time. You've got the LA Angels. You've got the old Washington Senators. And you also have a cross-section of baseball stardom at this time. Like I said, you've got the carryovers from the 50s. You've got Mickey. You've got Mays. You've got Sandy Koufax. You've got Don Drysdale. But you also have the young stars of the 60s. Pete Rose, Willie Stargell, Tommy John, Phil Niekro, but also, you know, some of the aging veterans still had cards in 1964, talking about Duke Snider and Yogi Berra. So a pretty interesting mix of cards in this 587-card set. And as I said, if you can find them in fairly decent shape at a decent price, again, you know, 25 cents a piece, something like that, this is a good investment. Grab yourself a stack of these cards, and I think you're going to like them taking a second or third look at them than when you were a little younger. Now, Minnie Minoso, or I guess I should say, if you want to be proper here, Minnie Minoso, there is an Enye in his name there. But if you really want to be proper, it is Orestes Minoso, who was born in Cuba. Now, there's some debate as to actually when he was born in Cuba, as is typically the case with Central American or islands players, Latino players. Typically, their advertised age is a little older than they actually are. But he was perhaps born in 1925, plus or minus a few years. And like many young men in Cuba in the 1920s and 30s, falls in love with the sport of baseball and loves it so much. In fact, Minoso was not a very good student. He would often leave class and go out and work the sugarcane fields. And when he wasn't working the sugarcane fields, then he would be, you know, making bats out of sugarcane and putting together local teams. In fact, according to the fine people at the Society for American Baseball Research, a great write-up by Mark Stewart on Minoso, he was a guy who not only wanted to just fill his free time with baseball, but he would actually organize teams. If the city he was living in, or not really the city, if the town he was living in didn't have enough players to form a proper baseball team, he would go out and recruit players and basically be in charge. And that was something that would really be a hallmark of his career, and actually kind of fit in with his style of play too. Minoso, despite the stereotype that Cuban-born players or Latino players in general were lazy and lackadaisical, that was not the case with Minnie, as he would prove to be not only a pretty good recruiter, but a hell of a baseball player, able to play pretty much any position, including pitching. And the story goes that he would have been catching too, except he caught the backswing of one batter, and his mother was there watching that happen. And she said, no, you're not going to catch. So Minoso could have played anywhere, but catcher was one that got struck off the list very early on. And as the story goes, as he was starting to make his way up through the Cuban baseball scene and starting to play for company teams in the early 1940s, he would notice that while he was best suited as a pitcher or an outfielder, one particular team, as he's trying to talk himself onto the team with the manager, he notices that the third baseman is having a little trouble. So he tells the manager, "Oh, I can play third base." And that's how he talked himself onto the team. So he's working his way through Cuba. And in the mid-1940s, baseball scouts are starting to really take a good look at Central American players and players from the Caribbean islands, and specifically Cuba. Of course, Cuba only being 90 miles away from South Florida, it was an easy trip, and scouts did not mind going to Cuba, as that was a vacation paradise and, you know, mafia-controlled gambling mecca as well. And because of World War II, when many players were overseas fighting, and, you know, Major League Baseball is dealing with, you know, these, you know, scrap players that aren't good enough to be in the armed forces, and they start up the Women's League just to keep interest in baseball going. Well, they start taking serious looks at foreign-born players, and they basically invade Cuba. And the Negro League's New York Cubans make an offer to Manoso, a contract that would pay him $300 a month, which is pretty, pretty good pay for the child who once took care of sugar cane. Well, he signs that, and all of a sudden, Manoso comes to the States and is starting to make a name for himself. So much so that the Mexican League, which, you know, now is the, you know, punchline to many jokes, you know, thanks to the movie Major League, we think the Mexican League is just a place where washed up veterans would get, you know, drunk on tequila. And unfortunately, that would be the case many, many years later. But in the 1940s, the Mexican League was an actual threat to Major League Baseball. Much like, as I've said before, the Pacific Coast League, you know, the American League and National League, even though this is, again, defined as a glory era of baseball as we go into post-war America, you know, Major League Baseball was in a very, very cagey position, and they would be for the next 15 to 20 years. They didn't really completely corner the market and fend off the Pacific Coast leagues and the Mexican leagues and the Negro leagues and you know, the planned Continental League until the early 60s. So talent is starting to get scouted out here. Manoso gets signed by the Negro League New York Cubans, and in New York, people are starting to take notice of this guy. And one person who did take notice of him and is credited with discovering him for Major League Baseball, although that's a bit of a misnomer, because like I said, Manoso was already blazing some paths in Cuba many, many years before. Well, Abe Saperstein, who was the man behind the Harlem Globetrotters, notices how talented of a player Manoso is. Saperstein is a friend of Bill Veeck, go figure, another promotion and marketing genius, Veeck at the time, the owner of the Cleveland Indians. And through Saperstein, they're able to track down Manoso. And Manoso is actually not the main target of a scouting project for Saperstein. They're actually going to take a look at a pitcher who was also a teammate of Manoso's, and that would be Jose Santiago. Well, Santiago actually sung the praises of Manoso and helped deliver Manoso to the Cleveland Indians. Now, the Indians weren't the only team that were scouting him. The Cardinals gave him a tryout but didn't sign him. Remember, this is 1946, 1947, 1948. Jackie Robinson had just broken the color barrier in 1947. So while an owner like Bill Veeck was looking at not only the possibilities of adding talented athletes, but also the promotional value of filling those 72,000 seats at Cleveland Municipal Stadium with a black athlete, and he would sign Larry Doby midway through the 1947 season, a lot of other teams weren't as progressive, and the tryouts were often just tryouts for the sake of tryouts. And players like Jackie Robinson and Willie Mays and Roberto Clemente and Minnie Minoso, you know, they would get paraded, you know, in front of scouts in Philadelphia and Boston and St. Louis, but nobody was seriously considering signing them, which is just an absolute shame. And, you know, to those clubs that just kind of did this little show just to make it seem like they were interested in signing black players, well, good for them for getting burned on it, because the teams that did take that chance Well, what do you know? They got better, and they were able to help break that color barrier. Well, Manoso is working his way up through the Cleveland system, just belting the ball out of the park in San Diego of the Pacific Coast League. And he finally makes his debut in Cleveland in 1949. But as it were, the Indians are starting to be a little overstocked in specifically outfielders, which was the position that he was working through at the time, mostly left field. He could play any outfield position, but he specialized at left field. So he gets a cup of coffee in 1949, appears in 8 games, goes back, again, is just killing it in San Diego, gets a cup of coffee in 1951. But again, the Indians just can't find room for him. And as much as they would like to keep him, by this point in time, Bill Veeck had moved on to the St. Louis Browns. The Indians are looking to run a little more of an efficient operation. So in April of 1951, Manoso is part of a massive 3-team deal. When I say massive, I mean there are just players going back and forth in this deal between the Indians, White Sox, and the Philadelphia Athletics. And the long story short is Manoso ends up in Chicago with the White Sox, and this is where he starts getting playing time. He plays his first full season in 1951, and he is the first of the Go-Go Sox in 1951. Now, let's take a step back here and look back at the Chicago White Sox in 1951. The White Sox, for many, many, many years, have played second fiddle to the Cubs, even though both teams, when you look at the grand scheme of things in terms of World Series championships and pennants won, you know, they're about the same. They are two teams with noted futility of winning World Series championships or even being contenders. Now, the Cubs, probably because of the friendly confines of Wrigley Field and the excessive TV coverage on WGN through the years, and of course, Harry Caray for many of the years, they've always been seen as the lovable losers, while the White Sox are the other team, despite having Harry Caray and Jimmy Pearsall doing the games on TV in the 1970s. So, you know, the White Sox and Cubs in many, many facets are essentially the same team in terms of wins and losses and futility and finishing in the second division. But the Cubs, for whatever reason, have just been able to lead the pack. And you know, the White Sox were almost always in their history in Chicago the other team. And, you know, their ballpark was on the south side. South side, you know, back in the day was, you know, primarily Italian and Irish. It was by the stockyards. South side of Chicago smelled like cow poop and, you know, beef carcasses. And then, of course, you know, in the 1950s and 60s, you have white flight. Crime starts going up and the economy starts plunging. And, you know, it's the South side was just never able to stay up to speed with the North side. And that's unfortunate because, you know, I've been to the new Comiskey Park, or was a guaranteed rate, you know, upside down house field, you know, whatever they're calling it these days. And, you know, it's a nice stadium. It's a good atmosphere. The White Sox aren't that good right now. But, until you actually sit and watch a White Sox game and kind of enjoy the sights and the sounds and the smells of the ballpark there, you realize, man, the White Sox are getting a raw deal. And that was the case in the 1950s. Now, by the time Manoso came to the White Sox, the Sox were often a second division team. You know, they won the American League pennant in 1919, won the World Series in 1917, finished a very close second to Cleveland in 1920. But ever since 1920, for a stretch of 30 years, the White Sox were just not that good of a team. They had some mildly competitive teams that, you know, finished around 500, but were never really contenders. And throughout the 1940s, in fact, the late 40s, the White Sox were just a bad team. So in comes this wiry 5'10", 175-pound black Cuban player named Orestes Manoso. Of course, by now he's earned the nickname Mini. And he is not only a speedy player, but the man could hit a ball a mile, and consistently. In fact, if you include his brief time with Cleveland that year, he would finish the season with a .326 batting average, a slugging percentage of .500, an OPS of .922, and 31 stolen bases as well, 14 triples, 34 doubles, and now people are looking at this guy going, whoa, he's really something. In fact, Manoso nearly won the Rookie of the Year award in 1951, fell just shy of Gil McDougall of the Yankees getting it, and also finished fourth in the MVP voting, Yogi Berra, your MVP that year. And he was an all-star, too, the first of four consecutive all-star appearances, the first of eight in his career. And things just took off from there, as did the White Sox. Now, the White Sox had some pretty good competitive teams in the 50s. The problem was the Yankees were always just a little better. They had just a little better pitching. And, of course, you have Mickey Mantle, you have muscle in the Yankee lineup, and the White Sox were not known for muscle. And part of the reason why they weren't known for muscle was they thought they could win without it. And when you look at the dimensions of Comiskey Park back in the 1950s, Comiskey Park was massive. 415 to center field, 352 down the lines, 382, I believe, in the power alleys. I mean, you would just have to just hammer the ball to get it out of that park. And those were the dimensions up through the 1960s as well. So if there was ever a team that was designed for the Punch and Judy station-to-station kind of baseball that was being played in the 50s and 60s, it was the White Sox. And another thing that really helped them was the field conditions at Comiskey Park. First of all, the grounds crew would take care of the stadium in a way that helped their situation. The grounds crew at Comiskey Park was world famous for just flooding the infield, you know, the dirt around home plate and the base paths to make the ground soft so that if a player, hit this slapper of a ball, it would just kind of, you know, get bogged down in mud, or they would trim the grass a little higher so, it would get slowed down. So while a catcher or pitcher is trying to chase down this ball that's just kind of dribbling through the middle of the infield, you would have a speed demon like Manoso just running right down the first baseline and, getting on base. Manoso was also known to be a guy who would crowd the plate. Pitchers absolutely despised him, not only because he was a good hitter, but he was somebody who was willing to be hit. In fact, Manoso led the American League in being hit by a pitch not just once in 1951, with 16 total occasions where he was hit by a pitch, but he would lead the American League in that category. Are you ready for this? 10 times in his 17-year career. And technically, two of those years, it's kind of an iffy thing, and I'll tell you why in a moment. But this was a guy who was not afraid to crowd the plate. He would wear a uniform that was bigger than his body, so he was always just kind of hanging over the plate, and he was very easy to get hit. Well, as the White Sox are starting to improve throughout the 1950s, despite falling short to the Yankees or in 1954 the Indians, the Go-Go Sox are starting to liven up the team, but Manoso would not be part of that Go-Go Sox team in 1959 that made it to the World Series. A lot of people forget that. After the 1957 season, he is traded back to Cleveland for Al Smith and early Wynn, and Wynn would be a key part of that 1959 American League pennant team. Now, Manoso continues to star in Cleveland in 1958 and 1959, but the problem is, once again, the Indians are going through changes. They're starting to run out of places to put him. He's also getting a little older at this time, officially 33 years old at the end of the 1959 season. So he is traded back to the Chicago White Sox, and Bill Veeck is now, again, the owner of the Chicago White Sox, the guy who brought him into Cleveland, and Veeck loves Manoso so much and appreciates his time with the White Sox, even though he wasn't on that pennant-winning team. he gives Minoso a ring for the 1959 season. So that was a very kind gesture. Minoso would pay it back with two home runs in the first game at Comiskey Park in the 1960 season. Another All-Star appearance, and this would be his final All-Star appearance, by hitting .311 for the season, once again in the MVP race, and once again proving to be a spark plug for the team. Now, Vec would lose control of the White Sox shortly thereafter. The new owners have no interest in having an older veteran outfielder out there, even though he was able to, you know, contribute to the team. So they shop him around, move him to St. Louis after the 1961 season. Minoso battles injuries in 1962, isn't really able to contribute to the Cardinals that much, is picked up by the Washington Senators in 1963. The Senators were absolutely abysmal in the 1963 season, so he mercifully gets let go by the Senators after that season, and the White Sox pick him up one more time in 1964. In fact, in spring training of 1964, he's signed by the Sox just in the nick of time to have his photo taken here and be included in the high series of 64 Tops. Now, the Minoso story gets interesting afterwards. He's 38 years old at the time. He can still contribute. He is still relatively healthy, although, you know, Father Time is taking its toll. He's no longer hitting .300. He's hitting in the low 200s at this point in time. But he still feels that he can contribute. So he can't find a job in Major League Baseball, so he heads south of the border. Like I said, the Mexican League was still going strong at that time. Not quite the threat to Major League Baseball as it was in the 50s, but the Mexican League would pick off some pretty good players in the early 60s. And he goes down to Mexico in 1965 and would play in Mexico through 1973. Now, we go back to the major leagues in 1976. Bill Vec, once again the owner of the Chicago White Sox, his second stint as the White Sox owner, actually saves the White Sox from moving. There was a good chance that the White Sox would move to Seattle, believe it or not, in 1976. So he comes in, saves the team, brings in Minoso as a coach, and as a publicity stunt, has Minoso play a game as a DH. So Minoso has officially become a player in four different decades in Major League Baseball. And he continues to coach, and then as another publicity stunt in 1980, he is brought back, and again as a DH, appears in a couple of games. Doesn't get any hits, but again, makes his appearance at the age of 54. So now you can say he has officially played in five decades. And this is something that would continue through Minoso's life. You would have minor league teams, the St. Paul Saints in 1993 and later again in the early 2000s, signing him to a contract, having him appear in just one game or a handful of, at-bats. And it's no accident that the Vec family owned the St. Paul Saints. So, you know, when he does these stunts at 1993 and 2003, you know, it's just a family tradition continuing here. But Minoso was game for it. He was all about spreading the history of the sport out there. So Minoso is officially the only player to appear in a professional ball game over seven decades. Now, even though Minoso's major league numbers, which are overall impressive, in fact, you look at 17 seasons, he appeared in 1,835 games, had 1,963 hits, had a little pop in his bat too, 186 home runs, 83 triples, had 205 stolen bases. While they're good, they're not great, so a lot of people don't consider him for the Hall of Fame, but consider this, and this is a great argument again brought up by the Sabre people here. If you look at his career as a whole, and that means Major League, Minor League, Cuban League, Negro League, and Mexican League, Minnie Minoso has over 4,000 professional hits. And it breaks down to, as I said, 1,963 in the Major Leagues, 429 in the minor leagues, 838 in the Cuban League, 715 in the Mexican League, and as we're aware of, 128 in the Negro League. Records were not meticulously kept in the Negro League, so that is why there's often arguments as to, well, how many home runs did Josh Gibson hit or Cool Papa Bell, and, you know, what did Satchel Paige have as a win-loss record? They weren't meticulously recorded or kept over the years, so that one's a little up in the air, but in total, 4,073 hits as a professional ball player. So with that said, there is a case to be made for Minnie Minoso to be in the Baseball Hall of Fame, and I say absolutely. Now, like I said earlier in the podcast, you have some other candidates who have some pretty good qualifications. You've got Tony Oliva, 304 lifetime hitter, who should absolutely be in the Hall of Fame. I've always been a champion of Jack Morris being in the Hall of Fame as well, as, you know, now he's up to the Veterans Committee. Morris, with the number of complete games he pitched, number of World Series he won, you know, three different teams winning a World Series with, he's the main reason why the Twins have a 1991 World Series flag hanging up in their stadium. So, and that's not to take anything away from Kirby Puckett or, you know, Gary Gaetti or Ken Urbeck or any of the other players from that team. But, you know, if Morris doesn't just have that lights out performance in Game 7, we're only talking about the Twins as a one-time World Series champion. But anyways, when it comes to Minoso, it's not only the 4,000-plus career professional hits, but let's be honest here. He was the first Black Cuban player in Major League Baseball. And okay, so maybe he was signed by Bill Veeck for promotional value, and maybe he was, you know, scouted by Abe Saperstein just because, you know, this was a guy who, because of his size and his tenacity, would attract people to the ballpark. But he was a real good ball player. He was able to make his mark in Cuba, later in the Negro Leagues, later in the Pacific Coast League, and much later in his career in the Mexican League. But he made quite the impact for a major league career, which, if you look at full-time status, it was a major league career that only lasted about 12 seasons. And the guy almost got 2,000 hits. So he was good athletically. He was a spark plug for a very exciting Chicago team throughout the 1950s and early 1960s. And he was the first Black Cuban player in Major League Baseball. That alone, that, I mean, being, you know, Major League Baseball spends so much time, and rightly so, honoring Jackie Robinson, honoring Roberto Clemente, honoring, not only Black players, but also Latino players throughout the decades. And you're really seeing that emphasis, and you saw it especially at the All-Star Game in Miami. You know, you're looking back at Louis Tiant and Juan Marichal and all these other great players throughout the decades. Well, why not honor the first one? I mean, so many great players have come from Cuba over the years. Well, if it wasn't for Minnie Minoso busting his tail in Cuba when he was younger, and, you know, Bill Veeck and Abe Saperstein basically scouting him out at a New York Cubans game and bringing him on board in the major leagues, perhaps the scene would be a little different. So, you know, I'm a big proponent of Minoso being in the Hall of Fame. I absolutely think that he should be. Minoso, by the way, passed away not that long ago, March 1st, 2015. Suspected death of COPD, a tear in the pulmonary artery. Officially 89 years old, but like I said, there are some thoughts that he might be a little older. Some have him as old as 92 when he passed. But I am a big fan of putting Orestes Minnie Minoso into the Baseball Hall of Fame, not only for his on-the-field numbers, and not only because of Major League Baseball, but again, over 4,000 hits in his career, but also just for the fact that this was the first Black Cuban player in Major League Baseball. Jackie Robinson broke the color barrier. Yeah, Larry Doby was in there very soon after. But even when Minoso made his Major League debut in 1949, there were still only a handful of black players, still only a handful of Latino players, and he was just as big of a trailblazer as Robinson, as Doby, as Willie Mays, as Hank Aaron, as Roberto Clemente, as any other player of that time. And I think he needs to get a little more credit than what he has gotten all these years later. So there you go, Mini Minoso on his Topps card from 1964, card number 538. Let's quickly take a look at the Wax and Gum Stains Twitter feed. Again, we had a lot of great conversation over the last few days. A lot of it based around our good buddy Sparty Hawk Cash in Kansas City and some pretty unique bobbleheads. I will leave it up to you to check that out at Wax and Gum Stains. So just type that in and look through our Twitter feed. That's been the main driving force of the conversation. But I do want to bring in a fun little note here from Jeff Dem, who sent in a note, I believe late Sunday night, sends us a picture of a stack, and I do mean a stack, of 1974 Topps cards. And he mentions, let me pull up the comment here, "I'm in the process of sorting all my old cards, had them sorted by teams, not year. Your podcast inspired me to sort 1974 next. I think it was the first year I started truly collecting at age 10. And that is really, I mean, the best age. I was 10 when I started collecting. And for me, it wasn't 74 tops. It was 89 tops. But it's great that we're able to get you to, you know, go through the collection once more and actually shuffle them around a little bit. And, you know, it's there's no wrong way to collect. I've said that before. No wrong way to do it. And the 74 top set is a great set to do it with. And it's interesting that you put them together by teams. I always did them sequentially. I always put them together by numbers just because that's how I'm organized. It was very easy to find a card that way. But glad that you're able to look through the stacks once again, Jeff, and that we were part of the reason for you to go ahead and do that. And thank you so much for listening. Also, a couple comments on our recent flashback episode where we had the 89 score set, which is one of my least favorite sets, but the random poll was one of my favorite players, Edgar Martinez. And that's another guy that needs to be in the Hall of Fame. And I've made this argument over and over and over again. I make it in the podcast. People go, well, Edgar was a designated hitter. Well, not by choice. Edgar Martinez was an all-star third baseman until he tore up his knee in spring training. And if he wanted to stay in the major leagues, he needed to be a designated hitter because he did not have the range to be a third baseman anymore. So he became a DH and a damn good one, thank you very much. And to all those fat newspaper writers who haven't paid for a baseball stadium ticket in 30 years, get off your pedestal for a minute. Look at what actually Edgar Martinez did in his life, including that all-star appearance, and realize that this guy should be in Cooperstown. Nathan replies, Edgar was consistently up there among the leaders in batting average every season. Absolutely. Church of Baseball notes, if you get rid of the DH, we never have this discussion about other hitters again. Well, again, the DH position actually saved Edgar's career. May keep him out of the Hall of Fame, but it saved his career. Josh Olson, kind of agreeing with me that the 89 set was a debacle. He says, I received an 89 score factory set for Christmas that year and immediately traded away the hits. I wasn't a patient collector at age 10. No, but you were very shrewd, Josh, because the 89 score set does not have a very long-lasting positive effect. It wasn't really good back in 89 and is certainly much maligned these days. Although baseball card backs comes to the defense of 1989 score and says, how dare you, this set is perfect. And the truth is, the 89 score set, the only good thing about it is the back of the card, and that is because the back of the 89 score set is just like the back of the 88 score set. Now, 88 score, and if you want to listen to that podcast, go through our archives, but 88 score, I think, is really an underrated set simply because It was very innovative way before other car companies were. You know, Upper Deck gets all the credit for reinventing the product in 1989, which, you know, they did. But Score was a little ahead of the pack, too, with the color photograph on the back, with some really good color photography on the front of the cards in 1988. But the backs of Score cards, and this wasn't just in 88 and 89, but it would continue in 90, 91, to some extent in 92. Not quite as good as the earlier sets. But the backs, I've always likened it to a scouting report. I mean, there's just some fantastic information on the backs of those early Score cards. So baseball card backs, don't hate the back of the card. It is actually a very good card. But the fronts of the 89 Score sets are just not that good. And, you know, Bowman gets beaten up like a redheaded stepchild in 1989. But I'm going to say it. I think 89 Score is worse than 89 Bowman. And I know most collectors hate 89 Bowman because you can't fit it in the plastic sleeves or the standard size boxes at the time. And Bowman would correct that in 1990. But I really think just in terms of innovation and design and you know what Bowman was trying to do in 89, Score just completely mailed it in. I think Bowman's better than Score in 1989. Then again, this is like arguing if a Ford Pinto is better than an AMC Gremlin, so let's not spend too much more time on that. Again, you can spend your time at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. Appreciate your comments, your thoughts. You can talk about our podcast, the players we talk about, the teams, the sets, or as was the case this past week, somebody brings up a topic and it just goes off from there. So make sure, again, you pass along the word about Wax and Gum Stains to your friends who collect or who used to collect and would like to kind of get back into it. Well, we're going to get back into our box here of classic cards. We'll probably pick at the other end of the box here and get something from the 1970s next week. But it was fun looking back at 64 Tops, the career of Orestes Minimonoso, and also just, you know, taking the second look at a set that I wish I liked a little more when I was younger. But I'm glad I was able to take that second look and go, you know what, this isn't half bad. It's interesting when you get a stack of these cards and you're able to thumb through them, see some of the, you know, interesting pictures, but also the, you know, like I said, that interesting mix of conservative, everything's good, you know, everything's nice and safe and clean and okay look on the front, but the, you know, kind of that wild look on the back of the 64 Topps cards, very representative of 1964. In America, believe it or not. Well, that'll do it for this episode. My thanks to you for listening. Don't forget, if you like what you hear on Wax Ecstatic, you can give us a tip, a cash donation at paypal.me/waxecstatic. Or if you're a Venmo fan, follow us on Venmo at venmo.com/waxecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. We'll see you next week with another edition of Wax Ecstatic.